This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. In this series, we're going to pull up some of New Orleans' lost and neglected past, things that put what we think we know into question as this city comes up on its tricentennial in 2018. We've got three centuries to cover, so why not begin at the beginning? Or one guy's beginning, anyway. The European beginning. The Euroginning. It's August 1717. The Company of the West manages all business in the French colonies in North America, and it's just received its Louisiana charter. For years, French explorers have traversed the Gulf region of North America, but it's not until this Louisiana charter that the French crown decides to build a town named after France's Duke of Orleans, who was ruling France for baby Louis XV. This town is called New Orleans. Now, as POTUS would say, let's be clear. The history of this place does not start with European capitalists. It started at least 600 years before all this with indigenous communities who lived where the French Quarter now sits pretty. More on that in future episodes. Okay, but back to 1717. Enter Canadian Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne Sieur de Bienville. He and his brother Iberville were quite the dynamic duo exploring the Gulf Coast, and like all colonialists in the Americas, they depended on the expertise of existing locals. After years of surveying the land, Bienville became determined to establish a city here, at this now familiar bend in the Mississippi River. This was the perfect location to found New Orleans, he told the Company of the West. The land was high, well, relative to the rest of the area. There were natural levees, the river was deep enough for docking ships, and being perched on the river gave the advantage to both defend this new home and establish a commercial port. Sometime between March and May the next year, New Orleans became official. There was only one thing the city's founder needed. Well, actually, there were a lot of things he needed. But first and foremost, he needed people. One small problem, no one wanted to come.
New Orleans and Louisiana, those terms were bywords in France. I mean, it just had a shiver of fear up somebody's spine, you know.
Right. People weren't doing too well down here.
Not well at all.
This is Lawrence Powell, author of The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans. He describes these early colonial years as a tenuous struggle, not only in terms of development, but mere survival. The sheer force of the natural elements, the climate, the terrain, and the unforgiving vegetation, made it near impossible to create a sense of civilization, not to mention to live past age 40. When Bienville founded the city, fellow French explorer Jean-Baptiste Bénard de la Harpe wrote,
"In the month of March 1718, the New Orleans establishment was begun in flat and swampy ground fit only for growing rice. The air is fever-laden and an infinity of mosquitoes cause further inconvenience in summer."
It's funny, I wrote the same thing in my journal a few weeks ago. Anyway, despite these conditions, the ever-stubborn Bienville was determined to set roots in what geographer Richard Campanella describes as a strategic situation more so than site. In his book, Bienville's Dilemma, he says, New Orleans was just as poorly located as a city, or more precisely as a dwelling place, as it is excellently located as a commercial site. Basically, it was the perfect place to set up shop and the worst place to set up camp. Fast forward to June 10th, 1718, when Bienville sends this update to the Company of the West money men back in Paris.
"We are working on New Orleans with such diligence as the dearth of workmen will allow. I remained for 10 days to hurry on the work, and I was grieved to see so few people engaged on a task which required at least 100 times the number."
Somewhere around 50 convicts had been sent over from Canada and the other existing colonies, like Biloxi, to help Bienville clear the site and build huts. But they refused to work, or they fled, or they straight up died. Bienville needed to prove to France that he could successfully build a city. To do that, he not only needed manpower, he needed a population. This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. Let's jump over to Europe for a minute. In this early part of the 18th century, the War of Spanish Secession had just ended, and tons of ex-soldiers returned home to France unemployed and traumatized. Crime rates spiked, and overcrowding jails and asylums were costing the country a lot of money. So, how do you stop spending money on criminals? Give them a one-way ticket to the other side of the world. Here's Larry.
Shannon Doty wrote a wonderful book called Building the Devil's Empire, and she had a great phrase colonization by abduction, where they would empty out the mental hospitals and the prisons, and they would round up the vagabonds, of which there were quite a number on the streets of the cities of Paris, and they would dump them here.
Did you know this? I did not. On November 10, 1718, an official ordinance was announced in Paris that allowed local authorities to arrest those labeled vagabonds and send them to Louisiana. The first shipment of these forced immigrants arrived on Gulf soil September 1, 1719. According to colonial records, these first New Orleans citizens included violent disturbers of the public peace, a libertine who had threatened to kill his mother, and a mad vagabond night prowler. Come on down, fellas! There were these specific police units called the Bandoliers of Mississippi, and they were created to round up these misfits. These guys were often bribed, too. Like, for instance, a husband unhappy with a wife or ex-friends who owed each other money. As a form of revenge, all someone had to do was accuse said enemy of being a, quote, vagabond in one form or another, and poof, their nemesis was put on the next ship towards the Gulf. You know how nowadays, if a wealthy family has an unruly child they don't know what to do with, they send them off to boarding school? Well, Louisiana was the French nobility's version of boarding school.
They thought this was going to be kind of a penal colony where they would be able to reform them and domesticate them into the habits of steady industry and domestic bliss, marital bliss, and of course it didn't work out that way.
I read this passage of Lowry's book back to him. In the name of family values, they had been forced into mass marriages. After the ceremony, the grooms would be marched in chains to waiting ships while the brides rode alongside in carts. What is up with that?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, that's family values run amok.
Yeah. Your book mentioned that Bienville was never into that idea.
Right. He was opposed to that. He felt that, you know, you're just loading us up with unproductive social misfits, social losers.
So France thought, let's force these people into becoming upright citizens. We'll make them marry, start families, put them to work, and best of all, they'll be out of sight, out of mind. But not for Bienville, who by this time was governor of Louisiana and wrote his frustrations to the crown.
Is it most disagreeable for an officer in charge of a colony to have nothing more for its defense than a bunch of deserters, contraband soul dealers, and rogues who are always ready to desert you, but also to turn against you, and who think of nothing but returning to their homeland?
There was another group of forced immigrants in Bienville's social experiment, enslaved people, many of them from Senegambia. From the get-go, New Orleans wasn't just a collection of misfits, it was a slave society. Much, much more on that in upcoming episodes. So with this unwilling labor force, progress was so slow in the first few years that maps were being made and sent back to Paris without depicting New Orleans. So while Paris was sending Bienville their grotesques, the rest of the world was ignoring him completely. Talk about neglect. You know, it's almost like you go to psychotherapy as an adult and you go back to the first 3 months of your life. And they want to know, you know, was your mother working? Was she this? Right? It's like, that's going to do something to your identity as a
city.
Well,
I guess it's true. I didn't think of it. I mean, we began as a foundling city.
Right.
You know, we were orphaned and abandoned.
Yeah. Feeling slightly abandoned by his benefactors back home, Bienville was paranoid these unruly misfits with no loyalty to him or his land would desert him too. But there was no going back, especially for a convict without a dollar to his name. And so, although it wasn't their choice, these orphans saw their arrival in New Orleans as a fresh start, a chance to reinvent themselves, choose new names.
And they would make up their lineages, you know, and they would, you know, give them, they might be commoners, but just simply putting a DE in front of their name. I mean, who's going to check? You know, you can't go on the internet and do a background check.
Right. It's like playing pretend. It's like someone putting MD at the end of their name saying, yeah, I'm a doctor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, we were, you know, a city of imposters in a way. You know, it's why Mardi Gras fit in so well with our identity. We could always put on new masks.
For forced immigration of Europeans was finally put to a halt when the last ship of exiles delivered 81 women to Dauphin Island on January 5, 1721. That year marked other major changes that ushered the city towards legitimacy. The first census was taken, and engineer Adrian de Pogger came in to turn what was, in Larry Powell's words, a swamp with intersections, into the designed grid that the French Quarter is today. And by this time, New Orleans was the most densely populated region in the Gulf South, half of those people being enslaved Africans, by the way. So this resettlement of dissenters marks the beginning of what writer Shannon Doughty calls rogue colonialism, a society where, as Doughty puts it, the lines between the licit and the illicit, between law and disorder, were blurred. Yep, sounds about right. Well, that's it for the first installment of Tripod. Only 299 stories to go. Tripod is a production of WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio, in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the University of New Orleans Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the theme music. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and I'll tripod you later.